I'm your brother Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now, the definition.
It's normal that when a new form of a new medium comes along, a new communications technology comes along, that this is very disorienting to our own hardware. The same thing was true when the book came along. I mean, the book as compared to the manuscript was a very powerful technology. And one could even say, I mean, even in our 21st century world where we claim that everything's so new and everything has transcended everything, or everything transcends everything every 15 minutes, the book is still a pretty powerful technology, even when stacked up against all the things that it's stacked up against now. But think back to say the 16th century, when the printing press is beginning to make hay. What happens is that people are overwhelmed by new ideas. Specifically, religious worldviews are challenged and religions fracture and people fight wars, and a third of the European population is killed. So we think about the book and we think that's enlightenment, but enlightenment happens 150 years after the printing press. And in the meantime, an awful lot of Europeans kill an awful lot of other Europeans. So I like to take that as the starting point, right, that new media are going to be destabilizing. And so the assumption that the internet was going to come along and just take a basically good world and make it faster and more connected and cleaner and so on, that was something that we should have been skeptical about from the very beginning. And now, you know, now we're seeing why it is we should be skeptical about it. Okay, so does the internet allow new things, or does the internet create a channel for old things? I would say it's rather the latter. We know, because this is something that people have theorized about since the Enlightenment, that in order for there to be a democracy, there has to be something between you and me and our fellow citizens, something between you and me and our leaders, which is a factual world. We have to have this thing called the public sphere, where you and I and our fellow citizens and our leaders agree that there are certain realities out there, and that from those realities, we draw our own conclusions, our own evaluative conclusions about what would be better or worse, but we agree that the world is out there. And that's important for you and I as citizens to formulate projects, but it's also important in moments of difficulty for you and I as citizens to resist our leaders. Because if we're going to resist our leaders, we have to say, on the basis of this set of facts, right, this is the state of affairs, it's intolerable, therefore we resist. If there are no facts, we can't resist, it becomes impossible. So there are a couple of centuries of democratic theory which make that argument in one form or another. That's an old argument. What follows from that is that if you want to build an authoritarian regime, you try to make that factual world less salient. You try to make the world less about the facts that are between you and me, and more about the emotions that will either divide us or bring us together. It doesn't really matter which. Authoritarianism depends upon people getting used to hearing the things that they want to hear. And what it does is it takes that public sphere and dissolves it, right? It says, there aren't really truths out there. There aren't really experts out there who can tell you those truths. It's really all about how you feel about the world. And that's true in old authoritarianism and in new authoritarianism. So, you know, Germans in the 1930s, who were no less educated than we are, probably more educated than we are, more literate, they got themselves believing all kinds of things that they wanted to believe. And they believed in them, many of them, right down to the bitter end. And they got themselves convinced that truth was not a matter of constant evaluation of evidence, but truth was a matter of some larger truth something that made them feel like they were together and that others were against them. That's all old. The technique that the internet permits is that it allows anonymous, distant actors to reach directly through our pupils, right, into the parts of our brains where the action really is. That's new. And then there are other things which might be new, like machine learning, right? I mean, that having to deal with, quadrillions of gigabytes of computing energy directed against my lonely cerebrum, that's something new, and that's probably only going to get worse. But the pattern is old, because what a social platform does, or even what a Google search does, is that it learns what it is that you want to hear, and it gives you more of that thing, and thereby slowly changes you. I mean, it shifts you away from a person who thinks there are facts out there, and more towards a person who just gets used to hearing the things that he or she wants to hear. You shift from being a person who could function in the public sphere, in the democracy, to a person who can't, right? So the shift is old, it's familiar. Some of the techniques, though, are a little bit new, and which doesn't mean that they're inevitably bad. It does mean that we have to recognize, as with the book, that you have to get a handle on these things. The tech is neither good or bad on its own, but you have to realize what the potential is and start to get a handle on what the negative possibilities are, because I think we're only beginning to start to see them. People want there to be an easy answer, and that there ain't, right? I mean, so until very recently, people were still arguing, Silicon Valley is going to somehow automatically solve this. Incentives or the nature of technology is somehow automatically going to solve this. That's not true. That's the politics of inevitability. And then, there are the doomsayers who say, humans are basically irrational. This is how it always ends. There's nothing we can do about it except wait for some calamity, And that's the politics of eternity. And that's also very tempting, but they're both tempting in the same way, which is they say, it's not our fault. We can't really do anything about it. We don't have responsibility. And of course we do. Okay. So going back to the book, it helped to do things like establish authorship. It helped to do things like have a page of table of contents, so it was clear what was being said. This may seem all totally boring now, but it really mattered to get the technology of the book under control. We can get the technology of the internet under control too, provided that we decide that that's an issue, right? Like, I mean, looking at it from the point of view of the larger economy, why can't we think about the internet the way that we think about other resources? Or why can't we think about our mind the way we think about other resources? If there's pollution, we treat that as an externality and we internalize it, right? The destruction of factuality, we could also treat as an externality, right? We could tax big companies, and we could use what we get from those big companies to support local news. Because factuality isn't just a matter of like being a crusader for it. It's a matter of producing facts. It's a matter of producing them not in DC or New York or Los Angeles or Beijing or Moscow. It's a matter of producing them where people actually live. And that has to be done. It has to be done by people. It has to be done by local reporters. The trick is not to say social platforms bad, internet bad. The trick is to say, how do you produce factuality in people's lives? Because the way the destructive process goes is that first the local news goes away. And this was true in Russia a little bit before. It was true in America. But in both cases, you see that basically the same pattern. First, the local news goes. And then people start talking about the media. Instead of talking about reporters who they know, their neighbors, they start talking about the media as something distant. And once that step is made, once people distrust, they start looking for other things to trust, which are big conspiracy stories. Because if the media is far away from you anyway, why not believe something, which makes the world make sense? So part of the answer has to be, how do we recycle some of these enormous profits back from these huge companies into the production of local news? Or to take a slightly different analogy, it's a little bit like reforestation. If you're going to make huge profits from clearing timber, okay, but after a while you realize you have to reforest. If you're going to make huge profits from driving people towards an us-them version of politics, maybe at a certain point you have to reforest, you have to replenish, you have to take some of those huge profits and actually educate people again, right? By, for example, supporting local news. So I think it's not technically that difficult to do things like this. And there are other things, there are other ways to think about it economically, like, for example, that fake news has an unfair competitive advantage over real news. Because, for example, you don't have to employ reporters, and you could try to correct for that, right? So there are lots of things that one could do. I mean, you could reclassify, which I think we should do, really, you could reclassify investigative journalism as a public good, which deserves positive public support from the state. I think that would be an excellent thing to do. So these things can be rejigged. There are technical means. But I think the fundamental answer is we can't say it's going to sort itself out or that it's not going to sort itself out. We have to think, yeah, if we like democracy and freedom and the rule of law, those things depend on factuality. If we want factuality, we actually have to go out there and find ways to recreate it in the 21st century. That's what I mean by history, is that history can define the problem for you, and then you have to say, am I going to take responsibility for it or not?
I accept your nomination with humbleness, with pride, and you and I are going to fight for the goodness of our land. Thank you. May the chair respectfully suggest to the delegates that we get this platform taken care of tonight, and then we can start hollering for whoever we want. And warning of the extremist threat, its danger to the party.
I have not here and kept this audience. Fifth of them. It's your job.
Now look. The governor hasn't had a chance to talk. He's been up here 10 minutes and he hasn't had a chance to talk for about 4 minutes.
Some of you don't like to hear it, ladies and gentlemen, but it's the truth.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
But it appeared to us that at least half and probably more of the New York delegation walked out of the hall at Senator Goldwater's last word.
The election campaign's in full swing in New Hampshire, bellwether state of the nation, that goes to the polls on March 10th to cast its vote. There are parades and rallies in the Granite State and lots of excitement as the candidates carry their campaigns to the people. The following specially recorded program is sponsored by the Goldwater for President Committee. It brings you Barry Goldwater's campaign in New Hampshire. Here he speaks out on the issues as he sees them.
The good Lord raised this mighty Republican Republic to be a home for the brave and to flourish as the land of the free. Not to stagnate in the swampland of collectivism, not to cringe before the bullying of communism. Now, my fellow Americans, the tide has been running against freedom. Our people have followed false prophet. We must and we shall return to proven ways, not because they are old, but because they are true. We must and we shall set the tides running again in the cause of freedom. And this party with its every action, every word, every breath, and every heartbeat has but a single resolve, and that is freedom. Freedom made orderly for this nation by our constitutional government. Freedom under a government limited by the laws of nature and of nature's God. Freedom balanced so that order, lacking liberty, will not become the slavery of the prison shell. Balanced so that liberty, lacking order, will not become the license of the mob and of the jungle. Now we Americans understand freedom. We have earned it, we have lived for it, and we have died for it. This nation and its people are freedom's model in a searching world. We can be freedom's missionaries in a doubting world. But ladies and gentlemen, first, we must renew freedom's vision in our own hearts and in our own homes. During four futile years, the administration which we shall replace has distorted and lost that vision. It has talked and talked and talked and talked the words of freedom, but it has failed and failed and failed in the works of freedom. Now, failures cement the wall of shame in Berlin. Failures blot the sands of shame at the Bay of Pigs. Failures mark the slow death of freedom in Laos. Failures infest the jungles of Vietnam. And failures haunt the houses of our once great alliances and undermine the greatest bulwark ever erected by free nations, the NATO community. Failures proclaim lost leadership, obscure purpose, weakening will, and the risk of inciting our sworn enemies to new aggressions and to new excesses. And because of this administration, we are tonight a world divided. We are a nation becalmed. We have lost the brisk pace of diversity and the genius of individual creativity. We are plodding along at a pace set by centralized planning, red tape, rules without responsibility, and regimentation without recourse. Rather than useful jobs in our country, our people have been offered bureaucratic make-work. Rather than moral leadership, they have been given bread and circuses. They have been given spectacles, and yes, they've even been given scandals. Tonight, there is violence in our streets, corruption in our highest offices, aimlessness amongst our youth, anxiety among our elders, and there's a virtual despair among the many who look beyond material success for the inner meaning of their lives. And where examples of morality should be set, the opposite is seen. Small men seeking great wealth or power have too often and too long turned even the highest levels of public service into mere personal opportunity. Now, certainly simple honesty is not too much to demand of men in government. We find it in most. Republicans demand it from everyone. They demand it from everyone, no matter how exalted or protected his position might be. Now, the growing menace in our country tonight to personal safety, to life, to limb and property, in homes, in churches, on the playgrounds and places of business, particularly in our great cities, is the mounting concern, or should be, of every thoughtful citizen in the United States. Security from domestic violence, no less than from foreign aggression, is the most elementary and fundamental purpose of any government. And a government that cannot fulfill this perfect purpose is one that cannot long command the loyalty of its citizens. History shows us, it demonstrates that nothing prepares the way for tyranny more than the failure of public officials to keep the streets safe from bullies and marauders. Now, we Republicans see all this as more, much more than the result of mere political differences or mere political mistakes. We see this as the result of a fundamentally and absolutely wrong view of man, his nature, and his destiny. Those who seek to live your lives for you, to take your liberties in return for relieving you of yours, those who elevate the state and downgrade the citizen, must see ultimately a world in which earthly power can be substituted for divine will. And this nation, was founded upon the rejection of that notion and upon the acceptance of God as the author of freedom. Now those who seek absolute power, even though they seek it to do what they regard as good, are simply demanding the right to enforce their own version of heaven on earth. And let me remind you, they are the very ones who always create the most hellish tyrannies. Absolute power does corrupt, and those who seek it must be suspect and must be opposed. Their mistaken course stems from false notions, ladies and gentlemen, of equality. Equality, rightly understood, as our founding fathers understood it, leads to liberty and to the emancipation of creative differences. Wrongly understood, as it has been so tragically in our time, it leads first to conformity and then to despotism. Fellow Republicans, it is the cause of republicanism to resist concentrations of power, private or public. which... which enforce such conformity and inflict such despotism. It is a cause of republicanism to ensure that power remains in the hands of the people. And... and so help us God, that is exactly what a Republican president will do with the help of a Republican Congress.
As the seeds of World War II were starting to grow, author Sinclair Lewis imagined a fictional future in which America, too, could fairly easily fall to fascism. He wrote of a politician who rose to the presidency by promising the nation great economic reform, a return to traditional patriotic values. He was a politician who vowed to save the country from welfare fraud, sex, crime, and a liberal media. And yeah, I know what you're thinking, but this really was all in Lewis's book. It Can't Happen Here, which was written 80 years ago, and which ends with the president all but ending democracy in favor of an authoritarian regime of his own. It was meant to be a warning of just how fragile American democracy may be, and now it's a jumping off point for a new book, Can It Happen Here? Authoritarianism in America. It's a collection of essays from some of the nation's leading thinkers, theorists, and historians on exactly how democracies can crumble. Joining me now are two of them, Harvard Law professor and former dean of Harvard Law School, Martha Minow. Good to meet you, Martha. Thanks
good
for being here. New York Times bestselling author, Cass Sunstein, who teaches at Harvard Law as well and edited the book. He's also a former administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Cass, it's good to see you, too. In your introduction, you write, this is not a book about Donald Trump by any means. I would say it is about Donald Trump by every means. Is that not a fair statement?
Well, I think I have to stick with what the editor said in the book, which is accurately quoted
by
you.
The editor's you.
The editor's me.
Exactly. Okay, fine.
So the book is really meant to be about America and its robustness against authoritarianism and its occasional vulnerability to the authoritarian impulse, which unfortunately resides in every human heart.
But would you have, would this endeavor have happened? You are not the editor of the book. You're a contributor. Were it not for the ascendancy of Donald Trump?
I think that when Cass asked me to participate, I jumped at the chance because of the issues that have arisen since the election, indeed during the campaign. But I will confess that as a teacher of constitutional law and as a former teacher of Barack Obama, I say to my...
He was one of your students?
Yes.
Okay.
I say to my constitutional law students during his administration, look at the powers of the presidency. Look how they have grown. What if they were being exercised by someone with whom you disagreed? And I watch them one by one go, oh.
Well, let's talk about some of the threats that are either addressed here or I know concern the public. I mean, your former student, a lot of liberals didn't think he was so hot in terms of his relationship with the press. But I think most would say Donald Trump has taken it to a new plateau. Here's a tweet from Trump in February of last year. The fake news media, failing New York Times, NBC News, ABC, CBS, CNN, is not my enemy. It is the enemy of the American people. Is this one of the kinds of things that causes you to ask the question, can it happen here, Cass?
Yes, that's a very alarming statement from the President of the United States. Our media, for all its imperfection, it is a great safeguard of democracy. It's essential to democracy. It's responsible for a part of the Constitution that all Americans cherish. And for a president to attack it in that way as an enemy of the people, that's I think the right word is that's un-American.
You know, speaking of un-American, you write in your essay here, Martha, you talk about the anti-Muslim animus here, both the candidate and
right.
And you also write about the internment of Japanese Americans. But the beauty, it seems to me, of our system, which would cause people to be less worried, I think, is the courts reined in Donald Trump on his anti-Muslim animus. Did they not? Essentially, you write about this in part two, about the separation of powers, checks and balances. So is it less to worry about because he hasn't been able to get away with his excesses on this issue?
Well, the hope is that the American institutions set up by the Constitution will be strong and will stand up. So far, the Muslim ban has faced many challenges, but it's not over. And the Korematsu case stands as a terrible precedent.
About Japanese American internment.
About Japanese American internment, where the courts did not stand up. And it still is good law. The Supreme Court has never overturned it.
When you teach that to your class and they don't know much about it and they realize that they're two liberal icons like FDR and Earl Warren, who had some involvement, some deep involvement in this, what's their reaction if they didn't know?
I think it is, for all of us, a reminder that actually in the spirit of doing good, very terrible things can happen, and our institutions, as robust as they are fragile, and they depend on the beliefs of the American people.
Let's talk about another piece of Trump that is close to what you both do for a living. Here is Donald Trump in May of last year talking about a particular judge with whom he was unhappy. Here's the president.
I have a judge who is a hater of Donald Trump. His name is Gonzalo Curiel. Frankly, he should recuse himself. We're in front of a very hostile judge. The judge was appointed by Barack Obama.
Has the attacks on the judge, I mean, I assume that's high on your list of concerns when you're piling up the litany of things that cause you to ask the question, correct?
No question. To attack our judiciary, and especially to attack our judiciary because the last name isn't quite right by the speaker.
Well, I called him a Mexican, actually, what he said.
Which wasn't true, by the way.
He's
American. People with German descent aren't Germans. They are Americans if they're American citizens. So this
like
was
Trump.
Like Trump. I had that in mind. And so that's not right. So what you're getting at, both with this comment and the previous, is to attack institutions that are actually rightly cherished part of our system of self-government. That is new, and that is not authoritarian itself, but it is a harbinger of something not good.
You ask about the attack on the press. No one who's in a position of power likes the press. But attacking the idea of the press, attacking the idea that there can be news, undermining the possibility that there could be some truth, that's terrifying.
Well, it's not just criticizing and calling it fake news. As you both know, he sought a cease and desist order when the Michael Wolff fire and Fury came out. But again, you know, it seems to me as troubling as almost all the things that we could talk about. The other day, I don't know if you even read this, it was fairly low profile, an aide to him says he talks in private about his admiration for the Philippines' Duterte, who just executes drug dealers without due process. Now, that may be an aside. I don't know. But much of the democratic safeguards are working, are they not? Some of the things you talk about in your essay, should that not cause us to be able to say, no, it really can happen here?
Yes. So the title of the book is Can It Happen Here? And many people who wrote for the book think the answer is no. There's a diversity of views.
You're a no too, aren't you?
I think it's highly improbable. But I guess I'd want to distinguish between the worst case, which is the rise of something that really deserves the name authoritarianism. I think our system is robust against that, and the development of things that are in the direction, like the internment of Japanese Americans, like some of the suppression of free speech that have occurred during wartime, like some of the invasions of privacy that occurred in the Vietnam era and after. And those things aren't, you know, it's not Hitler, it's not Mussolini, but it's something that Americans should concern themselves about, and whether the Democrats or Republicans, stand tall against.
Let me argue against myself, if I can, for a minute, in terms of the judiciary reining him in. While he withdrew this nomination, there was a nomination for a federal court position this summer of a guy who had used a disparaging term about Hillary Clinton in a tweet over the summer, others that were racist. Does the packing of the courts with people, I think these were among the very few voted unqualified by the ABA, the American Bar Association thing, does the packing of courts with ideologically extreme and in many cases unqualified people raise your worry about the ability of that branch to rein in an executive?
Well, it does, because over the course of one or two more years, the current president may be able to appoint 100 to 150 judges. That will change the composition of the courts. But worse, if they're perceived to be appointees because of their partisan views, it will undermine the respect for the institutions.
But if it turns out people voted for him and the Supreme Court issues were raised about the balance of the court, and we obviously have elected, his first appointment is somebody who has voted with Justice Thomas almost, I think, in virtually every single case, at least the first 13. They voted for Republican Senate, which chooses to confirm. So would you not in some ways argue that democracy is working the way it's supposed to, even if you may not like the outcomes of democracy, Martha Minow?
Well, I'd like to distinguish between disagreeing with this or that outcome or this or that policy from the undermining of faith in the checks and balances, the faith in the press, expertise, science, truth. Because if we don't have those, then the system as a whole won't work.
So what's the takeaway? I know it's not don't worry, be happy. Is it do worry, be vigilant? Is that what the takeaway of the book is?
I think the focus should be on particular things of the sort that you've described, whether it's attacks on the institution of the press, attacks on judges because of their ethnic heritage. We haven't discussed the Russian involvement in the 2016 mm-hmm. campaign. The failure to stand opposed to that as a direct attack on mm-hmm. our democracy, and the use of some of the same tactics that the Russians use, that is setting people against themselves. And I think it's good to stand a little bit above actually the news of the day and to focus on larger risks that even democracies are sometimes subject to. And I think to think it's terrible now and we're about to fall off a cliff is not as productive as to think what are the particular things that are dangers to us, and what in our heritage should we stand up for in the face of those risks.
But I wanted to start at the very beginning. You dedicated this book to Barry Goldwater. What would he, in your opinion, having known him and having dealt with him on these political issues, have thought of the current conservative movement as it has become? And what would the conservative movement have thought of him at this point? What do they think of him now?
Well, that's it. I think right now we can say, in fact, I discuss this in the book, that Goldwater Republicanism is really RIP. Mm. It's been put to rest by most of the people who are now active in moving the movement further to the right than it's ever been. I think the senator, before he departed, was very distressed with conservatism. In fact, it was our conversations back in 1994 that started this book. It's really where I began. We wanted to find answers to the questions as to why Republicans were acting as they were, why conservatives had taken over the party and were being followed, as easily as they were in taking the party where he didn't think it should go.
What did you find? in less than the 200 pages that the book goes into.
I ran into a massive study that had really been going on for 50 years now by academics. They've never really shared this with the general public. It's a remarkable analysis of the authoritarian personality, mm-hmm. both those who are inclined to follow leaders and those who jump in front and want to be the leaders. It was not the opinion of social scientists. It was information they drew by questioning large numbers of people, hundreds of thousands of people, in anonymous testing where they conceded, their innermost feelings and reactions to things. And it turned out that these people were, most of these that came out in the testing were people who had been pre-qualified to be conservatives, and then they found that this indeed fit with the authoritarian personality.
Does it really, do the studies indicate that it really has anything to do with the political point of view? Would it be easier to essentially superimpose authoritarianism over the right than it would the left? Is it theoretically possible that they could have gone in either direction, and it's just a question of people who like to follow other people?
They have found really maybe a small 1% of the left who follow authoritarianism, probably the far left. But as far as widespread testing, it is just overwhelmingly conservative orientation.
There is an extraordinary amount of academic work that you quote in the book. A lot of it is very unsettling. It deals with psychological principles that are frightening and that may have faced other nations at other times, and Germany and Italy in the 30s come into mind in particular. But how does it apply now, and to what degree should it scare us, and to what degree is it something that might still be forestalled?
Well, to me, it was something of an epiphany to run into this information. First, I'd never read about it before. I sort of worked my way into it until I found it. It's not generally known out there what's going on. And I think, from best we can tell, these people, the followers, a few of them will change their ways when they realize what they're doing, not even aware of their behavior. Mm-hmm. The leaders, those who are inclined to dominate, are not going to change a second. They're going to be what they are. So by and large, the reason I write about this is I think we need to understand it. We realize when you take a certain step and vote a certain way and head in a certain direction, where this can end up. So it's sort of a cautionary note. It's a warning as to where this can go, because other countries have gone there.
And the idea of leaders and followers going down this path and perhaps taking a country with them requires, this whole edifice requires an enemy. Communism, Al-Qaeda, Democrats, me, whoever, for the 2 minutes hate. I mean, there is, I overuse the Orwellian analogies to nauseating proportions, but it really was, in reading what you wrote about, and especially what the academics talked about, there was that 2 minutes hate thing. There has to be an opponent, an enemy to coalesce around, or the whole thing falls apart. Is that the gist of it?
It is one of the things that, believe it or not, still holds conservatism together, because there are many factions in conservatism, mm-hmm. and their dislike or hatred of those they portray as liberal, who will be anybody who basically disagrees with them, is one of the cohesive factors. There are a few others, but that's certainly one of the basic. There's no question that particularly the followers, they're terribly, very aggressive in their effort to pursue and help their authority figure out, or their authority beliefs out. They will do whatever needs to be done in many regards. Mm. They will blindly follow. They stay loyal too long. And this is the frightening part of it.
Let me read something from the book. Let me read this one quote, then I have a question about it. Many people believe that neoconservatives and many Republicans appreciate that they are more likely to maintain influence and control of the presidency if the nation remains under ever-increasing threats of terrorism. So they have no hesitation in pursuing policies that can provoke potential terrorists throughout the world. That's ominous, not just in the sense that authoritarians involved in conservatism and now Republicanism would politicize counter-terror here, which we've already argued right. That point on many, many occasions. But are you actually saying here that they would set up, encourage terrorism from other countries to set them up as a bogeyman to have again that group to hate here, a group to be, more importantly, afraid of here?
What I'm saying is that there has been fear-mongering, the likes of which we have not seen in a long time in this country. It happened early in the Cold War. We got accustomed to it. We learned to live with it. We learned to understand what it was about and get it in proportion. We haven't done that yet with terrorism. Mm-hmm. And this administration is really capitalizing on it and using it for its political advantage. No question, the academic testing shows, the empirical evidence shows, that when people are frightened, they tend to go to these authority figures. They tend to become more conservative. So it's paid off for them politically to do this.
This all seems to require not merely venality or immorality, but a kind of amorality, where morals don't enter into it at all. We're right. So anything we do to preserve our process, our power, even if it by itself is wrong, it's right in the greater sense. It's that wonderful rationalization that everybody uses in small doses throughout their lives. But is this idea, this sort of psychological review of the whole thing, does it apply to Dick Cheney? Does it apply to George Bush? Does it apply to Bill Frist? Who are the names on these authoritarian figures?
Well, you just named three that I discuss in some length in the book. I focused in the book not on the Bush administration and Cheney and the president, but because they really have been there, done that. But what I wanted to understand is what they have done is they've made it legitimate to have authoritarianism. It was already operating on Capitol Hill. After the 94 control by the Republicans of the Congress, it recreated the mood. It restructured the Congress itself in a very authoritarian style, in the House in particular. Mm-hmm. Senate hasn't gone there yet, but it's going there because more House members are moving over. This atmosphere is what Bush and Cheney walked into. They are authoritarian personalities, Cheney much more so than Bush. Yeah. And they have made it legitimate, and they have taken it way past where anybody's ever taken it in the United States.
Our society's best defense against that is what? Do we have to hope that, as you suggested, the people who follow wise up and break away from this, the sort of lockstep salute to, well, of course they're right, of course there's WMD, of course they're terrorists, of course there's Al-Qaeda, of course everything is the way the president says it? Or do we rely on the hope that these are fanatics, and fanatics always screw up because they would rather believe in their own cause than double-check their own math?
The lead researcher in this field told me, he said, I look at the numbers in the United States and I see about 23% of the population, mm-hmm. who are pure right-wing authoritarian followers. They're not going to change. they're going to march over the cliff. The best thing to deal with them, and they're growing, and they have a tremendous influence on Republican politics. The best defense is understanding them, to realize what they're doing, how they're doing it, and how they operate. Then it can be kept in perspective, then they can be seen for what they are.
Did any of this ring familiar to you from the Nixon administration, or is this a different world?
No, I must say that about everything that went wrong with Watergate, you can really count to authoritarianism as well.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example. In other words, not getting away with it was a result of it too?
Take Gordon Liddy and his following whatever Nixon wants, even the hint of anything he wants. Salute, mm-hmm. Yes sir, let's do it.
And the story that he has told about you and you've told about him, about him saying, I have all this knowledge in my brain that could bring the President of the United States down, tell me to go and stand on a corner, and what was the rest of it?
Tell me where you want me shot. He said, I don't want you shooting me on my house because I've got children, but shoot me on a street corner. That's a loyal, right-wing, authoritarian follower in action at the extreme.
You've been a historian, you've been a part of history, you've been to one of the central moments of history in the 20th century. What kind of danger are we facing, a legitimate threat to the concept of democracy in this country?
I don't think we're in a fascist road right now. Mm-hmm. We are so close to it though, Keith. That's why I wrote the book, because I want people to understand exactly what is going on and why it's going on.
It is an extraordinary document. All the best with it. John Dean, former counsel, White House counsel to Richard Nixon, author of the new book, Conservatives Without Conscience. As always, sir, great thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Keith.
Well, Yale philosophy professor Jason Stanley sees January 6, 2021 as part of a history of fascist impulses in American politics. That's the focus of his book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And in his latest article in The Guardian, he called America is now in fascism's legal phase. He spoke with Michel Martin about what he calls an extremely critical moment for democracy across the world.
Thanks, Bianna. Professor Jason Stanley, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, one of the reasons we called you is that you have issued in recent weeks a rather dire warning. You are saying that this is a pivotal moment in the life of this country. Why do you say that?
It's a pivotal moment because right now we're seeing the legal mechanisms to steal an election being formalized. We're seeing a system put in place that will enable permanent minority rule.
You said that we are now in the legal phase, and you see historical precedents for this, and you say it's almost like a conversation that has gone on for a century between the Americans who have fascist solutions to national problems and kind of the European experience. And you're saying now this sort of two-way conversation is resurgent in the United States through legal means. Many conservatives, many of the most prominent conservatives, sort of scoff at the criticism of these, what they call voter integrity measures. They say that some of these measures that are being enacted in the southern states and also really in states around the country, that they're just trying to implement voter integrity. They're just trying to give people confidence in our election systems. How do you respond to that?
Always say about your opponent what you are yourself doing. That's what we're seeing. We're seeing massive projection. We're even seeing the fascist label being thrown at Democrats, right? So projection is a standard propaganda tool. It was one that Goebbels and Hitler both explicitly recommend, but it's not just fascists who engage in it. But we're seeing this massive projection. It's almost like you can tell what the Republicans are doing by what they say the Democrats are doing. Well, we have to interrogate this. Electoral integrity. What does that mean here? Well, you have to filter it through a kind of fascist loyalist lens, which means only the real people of the country should get to determine who the leaders are. And so it's not a really fair election if everyone gets to vote. And we're seeing this again and again. We're seeing Republicans, including former President Trump, say this. If we don't pass these laws, everyone will vote. We're seeing them being very explicit. So the idea is that a real election is one where only the real Americans vote. And this goes back to this idea, which is unfortunately, unless things radically change, going to be a reality of a permanent minority running this country who, in the eyes of that minority, are the real Americans.
We already see this with the Supreme Court. I mean, the reality of it is the United States Supreme Court is dominated by people whose political ideologies do not match those of the majority of the country in any way. The question I have for you, though, is what's appealing about this to so many Americans? I mean, you've made the point, like other scholars have made the point, that the former president and the people who have embraced him, even though he's no longer in office, are sort of beset with this kind of racial anxiety. But what about these other people? What about these extremely wealthy business people who presumably have everything they could ever want, have massive influence in our society, whose companies are fueled in large part by the labor and creativity of many diverse people? So what's the appeal to some of these folks?
Power, simply put. We can't forget that, you know, people aren't racist by their nature. Racism is something that the powerful use to split the powerless. This is something, an analysis that dates back to W.E.B. Du Bois's masterwork, Black Reconstruction, which is still the best work about the American ideology. The wealthy elite faced a labor movement, poor whites, poor blacks joining together in a labor movement. So racism was used to split them apart. Racism is a mechanism of power, which is why you see many people who aren't personally racist at all, who are simply want their taxes cut, don't want government regulation, exploiting any means they can, supporting any kind of mass panic, be it a racial panic, be it a panic about COVID, to push people to vote for an extremist movement that's going to pad their pockets. And this is also consonant with the past. It's consonant with the past and fascist movements across the world right now, like in Hungary. Many business elites, particularly in the hydrocarbon business, they recognize that their work is against the public good. So they need to support a movement that will split apart the public and result in a system that they can control.
One of the points is that you just made is that the contemporary American fascist movement, as you describe it, is led by oligarchical interests for whom the public good is an impediment, such as those in the hydrocarbon business, as well as social, political, and religious movements with roots in the Confederacy. But the other point you made is that, you know, this is something we hear a lot of journalists in Washington, D.C. say all the time, is that, oh, these guys in Congress, or these people in Congress, they know that this is all, you know, made up. So what's in it for them? Like, why continue to maintain this mythology, especially when the person who advanced this mythology, the former president, is no longer in office?
Again, power. So let's look at the people who are sort of leading this charge against democracy. You know, Ted Cruz went to Princeton and Harvard Law. Josh Hawley went to Yale Law. J.D. Vance, Yale Law. These are the elites of the elites. These are not just the elites. They're the elites of the elites. And they know exactly what they're doing. When they foment conspiracy theories about the election, when they talk about, you know, a totalitarian government restricting our freedoms with COVID policy, they know exactly what they're doing. What are they doing? They're trying to create the idea that the government, the current government, is authoritarian, that it's corrupt, that it's destroying our children. It's a threat to our children. This is what the critical race theory stuff panic is about. And that you need a strong man to protect the nation and your children from this terrible threat. Look, as long as COVID keeps raging, you can keep the politics of fear and panic alive. And you keep the politics of fear and panic alive, people will set aside democracy. People will say, I just want to be protected from this. They're not going to be able to think reasonably and rationally. You need to present your enemy, your internal enemy. So fascist politics works by saying there's a nefarious internal enemy who's working in tandem with the minorities to overthrow the government and control your children. And so what you do is you make society complete. You you put people in an incredibly anxious and fearful state where they're looking for some kind of simple explanation. And a conspiracy theory is a kind of very simple explanation that people can grab onto. They're controlling the schools. We're hearing a lot about the schools. And there are very real worries here. I mean, we all want our children back in school and we want that dealt with. But, you know, the way to do with that, to deal with that is to address the COVID crisis. But no, instead, many Republicans are leaning into the COVID crisis because they want to make it worse. They want to say, you know, just like QAnon, it's an extension of QAnon. You want to say the vaccines are out to poison you, you know, all of these things by hypocrites who themselves are getting vaccinated and boosted. So this kind of constant conspiracy thinking, the internal enemy, wink, wink, is there. They're trying to manipulate you deviously. This enables people to say you need a non-democratic solution.
Welcome back to the Black Table here on the Black Star Network. We are here with the author of Laboratories of Autocracy, David Pepper. He also has a companion website, by the way, and you'll see it down below in the lower thirds, laboratoriesofautocracy.com. David, the first part of your book was very familiar to me. Like as we talked about before we started, I lived in Ohio for about 5 years, and Ohio is not a red state. We watch television and we see red states and blue states, but you know, as you have lived there your whole life, what you like fourth or fifth generation, I think. And when, you know, I got the opportunity to spend some time in Ohio, you make some very interesting points about Ohio. Some people might call you a cheerleader. I think you see your high school classmates say he'd be most likely to be elected president of the Chamber of Commerce. But exactly. But what you say about Ohio is quite striking. Do you mind sharing with our viewers, why is Ohio such a perfect place to begin this conversation?
Sure. Well, because we haven't been a red state. No, we're a toss-up state. We lean a little red. Mm-hmm. But we're not legislating like we're a little red. We're legislating like we're far, far right. And that's what happens once these state houses get hijacked by the far right. Then they gerrymander, they suppress the opposition, and that allows them to legislate in a way that doesn't reflect the people of that state. And one thing to be clear, and I really, I emphasize this in the book, this all began long before Donald Trump ran for anything. We this day and age, everyone equates the attack on democracy, Donald Trump, all of this was a backlash to the Obama coalition getting its way in 2008 in Ohio, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, for goodness sakes, in Indiana, in Iowa. The attack on democracy that I talk about in this book that we are seeing today began before Donald Trump ever thought of running for president. We have to see that. And it didn't just happen because Obama won Ohio, although that was historic. It happened because the Obama coalition, a diverse democracy, got its way. And there's a long history in this country, as you know better than I do, I'm sure, of a backlash, whenever a diverse democracy says, hey, we're now the majority. And that's what happened in Ohio and all these other states in 08. So the minute they had a chance in 2011 to say, oh, not so fast, we're going to gerrymander you, we're going to suppress the voters that make up big chunks of your coalition, so you're not going to be the majority going forward. That's what they did in Ohio. And they did it through attacking early vote. They did it through, as we talked about, where they privately in a hotel room they called the bunker, gerrymandered the heck out of this place. So that, you know, and when Obama won in 08, Democrats also won the majority of the Ohio State House. We had the majority of the congressional seats. So it was an up and down victory driven by that Obama coalition. And they basically decided in 11, never again. And with that, they created this system like in Tennessee and other states. You mentioned dozens of them. No accountability in the state level politics of places like this. And what we have seen since 2011, and this is the part where being that Ohio cheerleader, it's a painful thing to walk through, like I do in this book. Once you have no accountability like we have in these states, you see a downward spiral. Extremism, corruption, terrible public outcomes. and to keep it all going, further tax on democracy. Because if you had corruption and terrible public outcomes and extremism in a fair district, you'd lose your next election, wouldn't you? So yes, they have to keep locking down democracy to stay in power, given that they have results that wouldn't otherwise succeed in a fair democracy. So we see these states like Ohio in a tailspin downward without any brakes to stop it. That's why every once in a while, Washington and people who are on the coast will look at Tennessee and will look at Ohio and say, my God, how'd it get so bad? What's happening there? This does not look like anything like a normal democracy. It's because for years, these places have been in these sort of zones of no accountability, and the spiral downward is accelerating very quickly.
Actually, I'm glad you raised that, because, of course, we all learned as children here in the United States, and, you know, there are viewers from around the world. So, in fact, the fact that you spent some time overseas and did some work and then kind of bring that as a sensibility that informs the book in terms of the fact that the idea that the United States wouldn't tolerate this, this is what's going on in another country. But, you know, we all learned about the co-equal branches of government. But you make a very interesting point in terms of policymaking, that every time this kind of radicalized group of people who are trying to control our society and through the electoral process feel threatened, they adjust in the next election cycle to pass laws and policies. And you're saying there's even a tax on co-equal branches of government, and you use the Ohio Supreme Court as an example. Could you help us illustrate what are you talking about there? Because we're seeing in Wisconsin now.
Yeah.
This attempt.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Let me explain this way. Ohio had our Wisconsin moment in 2020. Mm. You know, Wisconsin, just for those who haven't watched, huge win when they won a Supreme Court seat about 3 weeks ago. Wisconsin's had among the worst gerrymandering and voter suppression in the country. This fair court hopefully gives them a chance to fix that. Well, we had the same thing happen in 2020 when we won the third Democratic seat out of seven after having had zero only a couple years before. And we had an independent-minded Chief Justice. So we also finally, for the first time in years, had an independent court. Here's what the gerrymandered legislature, Republican legislature, did after losing that court race. One, they changed the rules of how we elect courts so that party ID is on the ballot. So they hope to have the results of their court races be as partisan as they are. Number two, they are literally gerrymandering the appellate districts of Ohio to get better results. And number three, knowing that they would get a better court under these rules, or they hope to get that in 2 years, they simply ignored rulings they didn't like for a year and a half. They violated the Ohio Constitution seven times to gerrymander their own map in violation of that Constitution. And when the Supreme Court of Ohio said they were breaking the law, they just ignored them, and they ignored it until the new court took effect, because they had changed the rules this coming January. As you just said, and this is true about so much of the state house activity we're seeing, if we saw the behavior, lawless, undemocratic, extreme, banning books and, trying to ban our history being taught, if we saw the behavior in Tennessee and Ohio and Missouri and Florida in another country, we would literally say, my God, that country is losing its democracy in front of all of us. We call in USAID or the State Department to say, help this country not lose its democracy. It's happening in our own country, right up the street from where all of us live. And it's like we don't even see it.
Do you mind?
As you hinted, we're overconfident. We live in a sort of a privileged post-Voting Rights Act America where we think, well, democracy is here to stay no matter what. And my former boss, we talked about him earlier, Nate Jones,
yes,
and John Lewis would say, are you kidding? What do you think we had to fight for all those years to get to the 1970s and 80s? Democracy isn't just there automatically. Absolutely. You got to fight for it. And if you don't, you can lose it. But we've had this sort of privileged post-60s view that's all okay. So we see it in another country as an attack, and we would say to that country, you better step up. When it happens in our own country at the state house level, we hardly notice, and that is a real danger long term. And that's again why I wrote this book I wrote.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Vinyl D. Soap Guy. Yeah. And welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. I have a warning for all of you. And I ask you to take it seriously. This is not hyperbole. This is not me wanting attention. Back in, by the way, and this is not even easy for me to say, but I have been watching with intent, interest, as it was, but I've been watching everything that's been going on, and one question has stayed in my mind for the last year and a half, 2 years. Why? 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 Why is Donald Trump running around telling everybody that he lost the election? Why has his followers bought into what mainstream media calls the big lie? That he lost the election. Big shout out to Driftglass and Blue Gal from the Professional Left Podcast, who put the seed in my mind. Their second podcast, or third podcast, depending on how you want to count it, No Fair Remembering Stuff, put together an episode on the Brooks Brothers riot. For those of you who don't remember, the Brooks Brothers riot occurred during the Florida recount. It was a fake riot. It was a fake AstroTurf grassroots action that was meant to stop Florida officials from recounting ballots, which would have proved that Al Gore won Florida. Many of the people who participated in the Brooks Brothers riot have gone on to bigger and better things. Meaning they were rewarded for helping to overturn a legitimate election. Now, in the case that I'm speaking of, Gore v. Bush, some might see the term overturn as being a little bit too aggressive. They didn't overturn it. Gore never won. But Gore did actually win. Florida was originally called for him. And it was only when Fox News called the race differently did the other news agencies back off. Ralph Nader famously, and he maintained this and probably still maintains it, he famously said that 2000 represented a corporate coup d'etat. Most of us ignored what he said because progressives, including Tom Hartman, whose show I love, man I respect, but many progressives, many faux liberals, many faux leftists, blamed Nader for Gore not being placed, when the fact of the matter is, none of those people were guaranteed to vote for Gore. Even if they said, my second choice is Gore, doesn't mean that they were going to get up out of their bed to go and vote for Gore. But I've talked about that here before, so I won't get carried away with it. Besides, the important part is, Gore did originally win Florida. And then the corporation, known as Fox News, called Florida differently and caused the other news agencies to back off. Why? Because in the year 2000, mainstream media was in the process of being hyperly corporatized with a very pro-corporatist bent to it. This pro-corporatist bent was going to be decidedly conservative, neo-conservative at that, and what we would later come to see as being neo-fascistic. In other words, Fox called Florida differently, and the others got in line because Rupert Murdoch was seen as Big Daddy on campus. What does this have to do with the warning? It actually has everything to do with the warning. Let me tell you what the warning is. The Brooks Brothers riot was precursor to January 6th, 2021. And January 6th was a precursor to the next major move, which is to steal the 2024 election. There's been studies done where it is asserted in the studies that a massive conspiracy falls apart after so many dozens of people know, because one of those people are going to talk. So it can only be so big. Those studies are foolish. Those studies are foolish. You know how I know they're foolish? Because they believe... Well, let me first say this. I know they're foolish because conspiracies happen every day involving hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, and hundreds of thousands of people. And yet, those conspiracies don't fall apart. And often we don't even call them conspiracies. Sometimes we call them planning or strategic planning or business planning or what have you. Those are conspiracies. But even if none of those things existed, I would simply point to the Manhattan Project as an example of a really good conspiracy that literally involved hundreds of thousands of people, at least over 100,000 people. Conspiracies on that magnitude can succeed through the use of compartmentalization. You tell people exactly what they need to know, and not a step more. Not a step more. Moreover, these studies, so far as I know, don't take into account the idea of being a true believer, being primed to be involved in a conspiracy that for the person is local and localized. But that group is one group in 500 of true believers dedicated to doing the same thing around the country. Again, compartmentalization. You only know what you need to know. If it's you and 20 other people and your singular goal is to change the election results in one area, you don't need to coordinate with other areas. You just need to do what you need to do. Now, if you don't want to believe that, that's fine. I get it. But I want to ask you something. Have you ever heard of Moms for Liberty? A group who is working conspiratorially, with an additional T. And they are taking over school boards across the country and implementing a strategy which they clearly developed away from prying eyes, and implementing an agenda which, again, they developed away from prying eyes. Meaning what? They are operating in a conspiracy. Why do I think that they're going to try to steal the election in 2024? There's actually multiple reasons why I think they're going to try to steal the election in 2024. The first among those, and I believe the first, the most important, is because they believe, and Trump has said this, that something illegal happened in 2020, and because something illegal happened, meaning the election was stolen, all the rules are off. You can do what you have to do to right that wrong. To right that wrong. For those of you who do not understand this rhetoric, black folks in the South understand this rhetoric. When white folks during Jim Crow would say, oh, that nigga is uppity, let's go show him something, because he don't know his place, they were operating under the knowledge that that black person wasn't abiding by natural law. And according to law, or according to that law, when that law is violated, you can do anything you must do to reestablish order. All bars, excuse me, all holds were now open to be used. No holds barred. There we go. As I was trying to think how to say that, I'm like, no, that's not how you say it. But they have said this. And there has been a few people who have been captured on camera, in public, asking questions like, when do we get the guns? When do we start shooting back? When do we start raining down bullets upon these people who are taking our freedom? Because y'all been talking about it a lot, but when do we get to finally do it? These people are not lathering themselves up in violent rhetoric for nothing. These people believe, still to this day, a lot of them, that January 6th was justified. They don't care how many people go to prison. They don't care how many people go to jail. They believe it was justified. And if they can avoid having to pull another January 6th in 2025, that's going to be good for the country. So they might as well just try to steal the election to save the country. Sound familiar? Oh, no, I'm not talking about the first part. I'm talking about the idea of them saving the country. This is something that is floating around everywhere when it comes to conservatives and libertarians. We need to save the country. We must save the country. The country needs saving, and we are the ones who must do it. The second reason, why I believe they're going to try to and work towards stealing the election is because they have not been working, and Steve Bannon's been behind this, they have not been working to position themselves and their people in charge of election boards all across the country for nothing. For nothing. They've been working hard to position themselves into these places so they could be there to call the balls and strikes. They can be there to mess with those machines or if those tallies aren't what they want them to be, to call them illegitimate. You have Republican-led legislatures which have moved to literally strip people of their rights to vote by saying if they don't like, they've passed laws that say this, y'all. So don't think that, oh, well, this is just, you know, you're thinking. No, there has been Republican legislatures who have put forward legislation which says, yo, if we don't like the outcome of the race, we can overturn those results and say we want the other person. These people are not playing around. The third reason, because I know I said two, but there is a third reason. And I've talked about this one. I don't know if y'all is really listening, though. Because there is a third reason, and it's huge. It's big. You can't ignore it. They are going to try to steal the election in 2024 because if they don't, they'll never get a chance at it again. See, 2024 is the last election where the number of voters over the age of 55 are going to be, are going to outpace those under the age of 40. Possibly even under the age of 30, but definitely under the age of 40. And why is that important? Because over the age of 55, the people who are voting are typically voting more Republican and conservative. People under the age of 40, the majority of those folks are voting more towards the Democrats. The more people who graduate, and by the way, I should point out here, people under the age of 20 and 25, yeah, we'll just do 25. People under the age of 25, you're talking about, actually, wait, was it 25 or 30? Under the age of 30, sorry, real-time adjustment. Under the age of 30, you're talking about over 75% of those people are voting Democrat. They're voting for the Democratic Party. I'm doing my best to stop saying Democrat, like the Republicans want me to say. No, they're voting for the Democratic Party and telling the Republic clans to get to step in. The Republicans to get to step in. Under the age of 30. Under the age of 40, you still got nearly 60%. In fact, I think it's a little bit over 60% voting Democratic. They're not voting to the, they're not voting for the Republicans. They're voting for the Democratic Party. That's what they're doing. By 2028, the number of voters under the age of 40 who should be participating are going to outpace those over the age of over the age of 55, and by 2032, it's over. It's over. It is over. By 2032, the number of folks who will be voting will skew towards the younger ones. For the first time since the 70s, if memory serves me correctly, maybe the 60s, but I believe it's the 70s, you're going to have another generation outvoting the baby boomers. And it could happen as early as 2028, but it's more likely going to be 2032, depending on how many of those folks get involved with voting. So in other words, if they don't do it now, I've talked about this before, if they don't do it now, they'll never be able to do it. See, now, there's enough ambiguity in the numbers. There's the possibility of the swing 2 or 3 points nationally. So you can say, oh yeah, well, you know, Trump won, even though there's some funky numbers here, there, there, and everywhere. But Trump won. Where in 2032, the numbers are going to be too skewed. You're never going to be able to believe that. So they need to try it now. The good news is, we have the capacity to stop them. Let me tell you one of the fears that's running through the Republican Party right now. And y'all need, see, so many of y'all ain't paying attention. But I want you to understand what's actually happening. Here is the fear that's running through the Republican Party right now, because they're doing internal polling. And even though Frank Luntz is still working for the dark side, because it pays well, they're crashing into a stark reality. Young people do not only not like the Republican Party, young people see the Republican Party as that thing which is standing in the way of healing the environment, our country, planetary relationships, and altogether the human spirit. And that is what the Republicans can't shake. Their internal polls are telling them for 2024, they have a huge, huge problem. People are pissed at the Republicans. Their internal polls are telling them, while the map for the Senate suggests the likelihood of the Republicans taking it back, taking the Senate back, that is, their internal polls are telling them differently. Even in red states, the Democrats are on the rise. People are looking at the Democrats as more trustworthy and more able to govern. And the Republicans are seeing this in their data. They're not too concerned yet, because it's still a year out. They can try to tweak this. But I'll tell you what. Pay very close attention to who they get to speak around, not at, but around the RNC convention next year. Because if they try to moderate it, that means their polls are telling them in real time next summer that they're going to lose if they don't moderate. They're going to lose, and they're going to lose bad. Now, I started with the Senate because that's the more difficult chamber to keep. But even there, the numbers are showing the Democrats have a surprising possibility to not only retain control, but possibly add one or two seats. Depends on how they actually sell themselves. But it's a possibility, y'all. Congress, and this is where the real fear sets in. I was watching one of the channels that I follow that really dives into numbers when it comes to congressional and Senate races. And the person said very clearly, look, I expect the Democrats to take back the House. He's said that since 2021. He said, I expect the Democrats to lose the House in 2022 and then retake it in 2024. By how much? He's not sure. But he believes it could be by between 7 and 12 seats. Maybe more, depending. There's a lot that's still up in the air about that. Anyway, their internal polls are telling them Democrats do not have a chance to take back the House of Representatives. It's guaranteed. The question is by how much? By how many seats? By how many seats? There are districts that stuns them that are in play. Another reason why they're working overtime to get onto those election boards, because if some of these districts turn blue, I mean, a couple of them, a few of them are purple anyway, but there are a couple of red districts with 10-point, 12-point, 15-point leads that could turn blue. If they turn blue and the Democrats are successful with improving the lives of these people, they know those gerrymandered districts will not be red again. And not only will those gerrymandered districts not be red again, other districts around those gerrymandered districts will begin to think, maybe we need a progressive Democrat in the House of Representatives who will meet our needs. In other words, the propaganda is wearing off, y'all. And they see it in their internal polls. This, again, is why they're making moves. They see what's coming. They see the huge wrecking ball coming towards the Republican Party. They see it. And this wrecking ball is going to change the political landscape of these United States of America. And they know if they don't get in the way of it, if they don't chop the chain so that wrecking ball falls. And what I mean by chop the chain so the wrecking ball falls is if they don't step forward and do something unprecedented to take control, to take power, they're done. They're done. Even if they overperform, they're going to lose the House of Representatives. Even if they capture the Senate, they will lose it in 2026. And it's likely the Democrats, even if they lose seats, will maintain the House of Representatives. They know that. So their only real play is to go dirty. Because it's either go dirty or change. Once an abuser, they'll always an abuser, unless they get the help they need. And oftentimes, abusers are incapable of change because they don't want to acknowledge that they need help. The Republican Party is in that situation. They don't want to acknowledge that they need help. Which brings me now to my second warning. Second major warning, anyway. Because we have lived in a country where severe, orchestrated, out in the open, electoral violence has ceased to be a major problem in our political arena for decades. I mean, the 70s was the last decade when political violence was really seen as more of an issue. I mean, there was some in the 80s, but by the 90s, it had really dried up, at least stuff that was overt. Because this is the fact, though, we rarely consider that there may be violent consequences to ourselves just exercising our political and electoral rights. But with all of the talk of violence in the right wing, I think y'all need to really be prepared for something else. And it's the other side of them trying to steal the election. If they're not able to marshal enough troops to steal the election, or if their plan just isn't good enough and we outvote them, because we are going to outvote them, they see it coming. And let's say the Democratic Party keeps the White House, takes the Senate to new heights, so, you know, maybe adds another 3 or 4 seats and maintains control of the Senate. I know some people think that's impossible. And they take back the House of Representatives by a significant margin where they can get things done. And they do so with a mandate. Because that's the key here. You got to give them a mandate. And what do I mean by a mandate? Even if you can't give them a filibuster-proof Senate, giving them 55 senators is close enough. But giving them a House of Representatives where the Democrats have 20 or more, have a 20 or more seat advantage, is a mandate. It is a mandate. And so let's say that occurs. I am warning you now, because I know some of these people. They are going to get violent. Not all of them, but there are those who will. There are those who will. And it's a warning. It's not a threat. It's a warning. Y'all got to keep your eyes open on this one. You have to understand, these people for the last 30 plus years have been telling themselves that the more the Democrats are in control, the more the country destroys itself. Which is funny, because if you look at the previous 40 years before 1994, when the Republicans took back the House, and you look at particularly that first 25 years, saying that the country was destroying itself is laughable. Saying that the country was destroying itself is laughable. Those were some of the most prosperous years in American history. The problem with inflation came mostly from oil prices and the need to probably price control so corporations wouldn't gouge. But that's just my speculation. When you then look at the next 15 years, when the Democratic Party started playing patty cake with the neoconservative movement towards trickle-down economics, that is when the destruction of the society really began to take hold, and the problems in that economic philosophy begin to really show up. Then you compare that to the last 30 years with the Republican Party taking back the House periodically, and look at the state of the country. This idea, though, that the country gets worse whenever the Democratic Party is in office, one, is irrational, because nothing changes that quick. I mean, the moment Biden took office, they were saying, oh, he's a socialist, and he didn't turn the government, you know, into a socialist this, and he's destroying. The guy literally took office, and they were talking about that. So that's how you know there's no logic here. This is just propaganda. These are catchwords. That stated, do not underestimate how fearful the true believers of this nonsense are. We're already seeing people get arrested for trying to commit violent acts presently, or even threatening to commit violent acts presently. And just a quick note, there was one person from the left who suddenly started having thoughts of killing somebody on the right. They literally called the police and were like, I'm having these thoughts and I know it's not right. I shouldn't be having these thoughts, but they're there. Help me. This is a major difference between a lot of conservatives who hold fast to that hyper-individualism and the social-centric leftist. Whether they're progressives, which is center-right, or center-left, I mean, or real leftists, communist, socialist, anarchist, all of those. Because we are not the center of our world, we can see when we're about to hurt somebody, which needs to be understood. So these people have been whipped into a lather about the threat of the Democratic Party holding control of Washington. And that could spell disaster when the Democrats control all three branches after the 2024 election. Now, I could be wrong, and Lord knows I hope I am, about the violence. I hope the Democrats take back and will hold the Senate and hold the White House and take back the House of Representatives. I don't know if it's possible, but I believe it's possible. finally, one more thing before I go. This really is up to you all who are listening to this. Understand something. The reason fascism took hold in Italy and in Germany and in Spain to an extent was because the people allowed it to be voted in. You are more powerful than you give yourself credit for. And yes, we have been taught that voting doesn't matter much. Don't listen to it. Voting could be a powerful tool. It depends on what you do after you vote, though. So many people voted for Barack Obama. Seldom did those people follow up with what Barack Obama told you to do. He said, you want me to do it? Make me do it. As one of the elders in our community says, we didn't build movements during electing Obama. We thought electing Obama was the movement. It wasn't. Forcing, and Chris Hedges talked about this. I give Chris Hedges mad credit for this. Forcing Obama in the state to capitulate to what we need them to do was what we didn't do. The same must be done now. But you can only do that if you vote them in first. Not only do you vote them in, though, you vote them in with the understanding. If you get these things done, more of us will vote for you. If you don't get these things done, good luck, because we got the power to make you a one-term person. Not only just a one-term person, but to make that term very, very, very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. This should be written down somewhere where you can read it often. The political class, it's a small class, works for you. But you have to make them work for you. Build movements. How do you build movements? Well, it's not as easy as it sounds. But the first thing you can do, get to know your neighbors. Not only get to know your neighbors, but get to know what their needs are. Not only get to know what their needs are, figure out what needs you all can fulfill for each other. And then figure out which needs you require local politicians to take care of, regional politicians to take care of, state politicians to take care of, and national politicians to take care of. Now, obviously, clearly, that's a lot of work. But here's where the movement idea really comes into focus. When you have enough of your neighbors known, you can start to structure yourself in a way which will allow you to take information and bundle it together. Once you bundle that information together, you can analyze it. Now, in both instances, typically, this is where you start getting into an organization with a structure of engagement with the community, and yet a structure that sets apart to be able to do its work within the community. Once that occurs, you have the capacity to bring the unified collective strength of that group to bear on any politician that you want to bring it upon. And allowing politicians to know that that strength is there, that that group is there, gives you the capacity to have your needs met. You dig? If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. Go to radio4all.net. Type in Class War Battlefield Podcast into the search bar. You could just simply type in Class War 2. It'll come up. And then just click any of the titles. If you want to reach me directly, go to Contact Contributor. Send me a message through there. I will get it. You know, big up to Dr. Oba the Shaka, to the Black Power Black Power Media, I Mix What I Like, Remix Morning Show, Professional Left Podcast, Majority Report. I mean, I take enough content from them, so I might as well say what's up to them. Best of the Left Podcast, Brother Jay over there at Best of the Left, Nicole Sandler. Again, another great show that you're not listening to. Yeah, and that'll be it for right now. Again, if you can give any money to this endeavor, to this podcast that I'm doing here, do so at CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, Cash App, PayPal. Hook me up. I'm hoping by the beginning of this coming up year to have a CWB Podcast Patreon. It won't be much. I do have extra shows that I could publish, but I'll let you know when I decide to launch that. That being said, family, thank you for joining me. I'm your brother, Vladimir Diesel. Guy, yeah! And I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Till the next one, y'all. Peace.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lives in the balance.